It's such a simple idea. If this is my batch of problems, and let's say this is my life, it's a little bigger, but it's still not much. My problems are still most of it. So what people try to do is like, I need to reduce these problems. That's what they try to do. And I say, or what if you forgot about the problems for a minute and you tried to grow your life? What happens to those problems once you have that many resources that you've grown organically to fix these things?
Welcome to Potent, the podcast where we explore transformative ideas and practices to help you live into your unique potential and build a more potent life. I'm your host, Stephen Lawson, a whole person productivity coach and founder at Monk Manual. Today, I'm joined by my friend, Dr. Julie Helmerich, founder of Iron Psych. Dr. Helmerich is a psychologist with over 40 years of experience helping high-achieving individuals, committed couples, and small business owners shift narratives so that they can get unstuck around health issues, relationship concerns, and wealth creation. On today's episode, we explore the concept of narrative psychology and how focusing on our own internal narratives can be the perfect hidden opportunity for getting unstuck and finding your own path forward to a more potent life. I've been interested in the role narrative plays into our lives for quite some time, and I think you're going to find this conversation to be incredibly inspiring and helpful. This podcast is brought to you by the Monk Manual. The Monk Manual is dedicated to providing best-in-class tools for helping you build a more potent life and experience peaceful being and purposeful doing on a daily basis. If you'd like to be more intentional with your time and energy, please visit monkmanual.com. All right, let's dive in. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Yeah, super happy to be here. I'm a huge fan of what you're doing with the Monk Manual. I would like to start this, if I could, with a real appreciation of you. I can't even tell you how genuine this is, but I trained as a psychologist, so I've been doing personal development work with people for 40 years. 3 years into that, I really realized, like, I need some kind of a planner or some kind of a journal that makes journaling easy, and because we do a lot of journaling. So I started looking, and there are a lot out there. And I really thought, I mean, I was getting desperate. I thought, oh, man. Then I found the Monk Manual. I literally started tearing up. I'm like, this is exactly what I've been looking for. And it was beautiful. You know, the color I thought would work for everybody. And, you know, we do narrative shifting. And what you do in the Monk Manual is, you know, you write a little bit every day, the reflection part, right? So highlights when were you at your best. You know, that phrase, when was I, it's unrest. What's the phrase?
Something along the lines of, when did I feel unrest? I should know the exact term, but something along those lines.
I know. And that's genius. I mean, the use of the word unrest versus anything else, because, you know, our work is like, go inside. What's the story you're hearing? To do that reflection with those particular statements. When I got to that one, that's when I went, okay, perfect. And that's probably when I fired off an email like, hey, we're going to be getting a bunch of these from you. Is that okay? When you stake your reputation on somebody else's product, that's a thing.
Yeah. You just touched on a lot of things that actually go to the heart of why I was really excited to talk to you today, because the way we position the Monk Manual online, largely because we need to, in a sense, speak to a category that people understand and know. We present it as a planner, productivity system. But really what I'm most interested in is meaning. And a lot of the actual Monk Manual work is in rewriting stories, trying to become more clear, more aware. Because in my experience, that is what ultimately really changes our lives, right? We can think of ourselves kind of like this mechanistic machine and think that if we just do this and that, it's going to go and stick. And I know you talk a lot about this idea that there's a lot more foundational work that needs to happen in order for things to really come together. And I'd love to actually start by asking you how you found yourself on this path of really focusing in on specifically narrative psychology, on how story works, on how our own inner story works. Because when you get trained, I imagine there's so many competing
ways of approaching the human person, right? There's, even if you go to a therapist, it's not like going to a doctor where it's all, everyone's looking at the problems in the same way. They might be looking at it actually radically different, right? So what is it that led you to specifically say, look, narrative psychology, this is it?
All right. Let me see if I can make this really long story short. Sure. I got into psychology because of a suicide in my life when I was 14, a family friend who was 21, an adult to me, I was 14, wanted to grow up to be like her. She shot herself. And I spent that summer and the next year, I grew up on a farm, so milking cows. And I just kept rolling over and like, how can somebody who seemed that happy, and she was, you know, upper middle class, there's plenty of money. I grew up on a farm, there was always short of money. And she was pretty and she was bright and she was really kind. And then she shoots herself. And I remember being really angry for quite a while with the experts in the picture, like, why didn't you know better? And then I had this moment that went something like, oh, you thought she was happy too, Julie. So she was on my mind for kind of forever. Like, what was she telling herself for crying out loud? Mm. I mean, I did have that idea. So I got a degree in psychology. I thought maybe I should be a guidance counselor. And my English teacher in high school said, no, what you're interested in is called psychology. And that's the first time I ever heard the word psychology. Neither of my parents went to high school, let alone college. So, you know, all this stuff was pretty new to me. So I just took a couple of classes, and that's where I met my mentor. And his idea, he didn't call it narrative. He called it personal meaning. Mm. So the idea is, here's an event of observation. You can see it, you can hear it, you can smell it, whatever, but it's sensory. And then the meaning that you put to that is about you, and that that can change. And we've really pulled from that methodology, which is really kind of pure form, looking at your narrative in real time, to like, that's, you all have to be in the same room to do that. It's pretty hard to do, and it doesn't scale, and you have to think, man, I might want to reach more people. So then I tried to figure out how to bring that online. But the reason that I never moved away from meaning was I saw what it did. Mm. It's the meaning they're putting to the events of their life that's a significant thing. I called it meaning. Narrative psychology actually came into my consciousness much later. I mean, after I had my PhD was when people were basically pulling together these threads in academic psychology and saying they have these things in common. And then I don't even know when somebody started saying narrative. And I read that and I went, oh, I'm there. That's like, oh, I finally found my people. Mm-hmm. Because there's a part of psychology, and I mean, you ran into this because I saw this on your website the other day. You used the word positive psychology. And what I find funny about that is, look, we had to differentiate one part of psychology from the other part of psychology by using the word positive.
Sure.
So what's the other part? It is a little bit negative. The idea of what's wrong with people. It's your anxiety, this, your depression, that, your addiction, this. Like, and I just knew that when I was working with people on meaning, I never thought about what's wrong with them. I was just basically following the lead of a mentor that I just thought he had such profound impact on everybody. And I used to say to people, I can kind of feel my brain changing from the working with him. And that was, it felt physical, like I feel like my brain is changing. Mm-hmm. And now I know it actually was. And the growth was just really accelerated. My GRE scores went, they went up 100 points. That never happened. So, and now I would say what was happening was there was an integration going on. Mm-hmm. Because he and about six other psychologists worked in inpatient hospitals before psych meds were in the picture. And the governor recruited them there and said, empty these hospitals. So he tasked these six psychologists with figuring a way to get them out of the hospital and, importantly, keep them out. Mm-hmm. And they didn't know what they were doing, but they were all using a methodology that the business schools used, which was called case method. Mm-hmm. Which was, you describe what happened in a business, usually one that failed. You just describe it all. And then in the class, they sit around and they go, oh, I think this, I think that. And the whole point is to create more meaning by everybody putting their what they're seeing in that picture. Your meaning is like a potluck, right? Bring what you have. You don't know who's going to eat it. Just bring what you have. So it was called case method. They were all familiar with that. And they thought, why don't we try that with the psych students? Now, again, this was before any kind of psych meds were being used. So in other words, the psych meds didn't interfere with what they found. So they had people in those groups and they had them put the meaning that they had to the events that were happening in that group that day. Mm-hmm. And they were discharging people who never came back, who had symptoms of schizophrenia that they went away. Now, there would be people who are listening to this who will believe that's just impossible, but that's because a narrative came in later. The narrative was, it's a brain disease, it's a chemical imbalance, and we can get that straightened out with serotonin. I'm not opposed to people using medication. They're just going to help with symptoms. That's what they do. They reduce symptoms. Now, that might be a major improvement for somebody, and that's probably enough of a reason to do it. But it doesn't get at root cause. Mm-hmm. And so root cause, as I looked at it, and as I was trained with my mentor, was the lack of a particular kind of growth, intellectual, emotional integration. And that's narrative. Mm-hmm. So when people change their narrative, they create a whole world of possibility. Like, here's a little thing that I say on multiple videos. This is absolutely the number one thing that people share. It's such a simple idea. If this is my batch of problems, and let's say this is my life, it's a little bigger, but it's still not much. My problems are still most of it. So what people try to do is like, I need to reduce these problems. That's what they try to do. And I say, or what if you forgot about the problems for a minute and you tried to grow your lives? Mm-hmm. What happens to those problems once you have that many resources that you've grown organically to fix these things? And what really happens, Stephen, which I love, is that the problems get solved in ways that I think most therapists would never think of. Mm-hmm. It wouldn't occur to us that the way to manage this or that thing with the in-laws is to arrange it this way or that way. You know, we'd probably think, let's talk it out, which has been a joy to me. They just come up with these genius kind of organic solutions to their own problems. Mm-hmm. And I see my role as just trying to help reinstitute that kind of psychological growth that I think along the way has ceased. And part of what I love about the Monk Manual is I really, most of that kind of reinstitution of that kind of psychological growth is done by asking quiet little questions day in and day out, day in and day out. We always give journaling prompts around here. They're modified to a particular thing that we're taking a look at, because we look at getting above the line, we call it, which is health. Then we look at relationships and we look at money and all the narratives that are connected to those. And even when somebody has identified a really problematic narrative, it's not like it's over. Like, no, now you have to create like at least one that neutralizes that narrative. And then ideally one that really pulls you forward towards the life you want. And part of what I love about what happens when people are journaling, you know what the Monk Manual does is it's right there. It's right there. You know, you're checking off what you're doing, but it's right there. And yeah, you're just looking at these little things all day long, like checking off, I had this meeting, I had that meeting. You put in a little note, got to put this over there. And then right over there is unrest. Right over there was at my best. Right, you know, you're thinking about it. It keeps people in the here and now, because one of the parts of that methodology was the here and now. And you preach this too. I mean, I watch your stuff and I'm like, yeah, we go preach, Steve. You know, you can't make a difference in your life except if you were in the here and now. That's the point of contact with where differences are made. Mm-hmm. You know, so you and I are kindred spirits here, even though we've never met in person, even though we came at this from very different angles. But no, I'm a huge fan of what you do, because it really is very supportive, I think, of narrative shifting, which is the work we do.
When people come to you, because I know you work with a lot of different people who probably are coming from a lot of different backgrounds, a lot of different perspectives, and probably have fairly unique problems, right? Or at least apparently, at least apparently unique problems.
Right.
Do you find that their path regardless of their problems, tends to rhyme with each other? Like, is there a similar path?
A little bit.
And what is that path?
The path is away from a narrative that was created for them by other people, and sometimes with a lot of intended love, often, to their own inner authority, we call it. And inner authority basically is taking full responsibility for the meaning that you put to events in your life and events around the world. You know, one of the worst things probably about social media is the amplification of extreme meanings. Mm. And most people, if you meet a one-on-one, you can get along with them, regardless of which post they might have liked or loved. If the two of you were sitting there having coffee and you got to what was keeping you awake at night, it's going to be like, I don't know, I just want my kids to have a good life. So I feel like we have a lot more in common. I think the path is from everybody's also different, we're also different, I could never relate to so-and-so, to some sort of like, are you sure we're not one? Maybe we're one. You know, I think it goes in that direction. It goes away from, I know what's going on, I got this too, like, I don't know. It goes in the direction of like, this is going to work, to like, I don't know, I'm going to try this, see what happens, and then I'll modify it. So I think people get better and better at iterations. They stop thinking they have to completely reinvent themselves and be so unfriend all your in-laws and block everybody. I mean, maybe you need to find out when they really irritating, I would say Uncle Joe, my apologies to all the Joes out there. The really irritating Uncle Joe who sits at the end of the counter drinking too much and spewing hatred in this kind of ism or that kind of ism or that kind of ism, whichever ism is the ism of the day. Maybe you just need to go earlier. How about that? You know, and I don't come up with these things. I'll say like, yeah, no, we're not doing any of that. We just decided we're going to go earlier and leave earlier. Like, oh, good idea. It's almost impossible to describe why that particular thing was so profound, because it sounds so simple. Mm-hmm. What did you do? I decided to put my phone down when my husband started talking to me. Like, that's a tactical thing. You could tell somebody all day long to do that, but to have the narrative shift where she's saying, do I want to be the kind of wife who, when my husband is talking about me at my funeral, he says, I loved it when I could get through to her, because those were great conversations when we had them. Like, do you want to be that one, or do you want to be the one where he says, I can't even tell you what it felt like that every time I walked in with something on my mind, I became her sole focus. I just wish everybody out there had that kind of love. Which one do you want to be? So the narrative that undergirds the behavior is the significant thing. That's part of why people do kind of go in the path of, what do other people want me to do? What would they approve of me? How would I get more followers? And I mean more followers, like, yes, media-wise, but I also think that has really gotten in people's heads. The idea of how many of the people in the family are on my side. I don't know. If you interviewed them all, they'd probably be a little against you and a little for you. I mean, there's probably a whole mix of a bunch of stuff in there if you really sat down and had a deep conversation. So are followers what you really want? I mean, are you running for office, or are we, you know, like the rest of us, trying to have a... I mean, around here, we talk a little bit about this phrase, a profound life. That a profound life just means a life that matters to you. That when you get up in the morning, you go, way to go, Jules. Nice job. Not getting anybody on Pinterest or wherever giving me a standing ovation, but I'm giving myself a little bit of one, because you know where you started, you know where you came from, you know what you overcame, and also you know you're still in the game. I'm still in the game. I'm willing to do my part. So I do think people become less self-absorbed, more other-centered without becoming a martyr. Self-care becomes way more important to them. We say they move from like toxic narratives to a kind of inner authority where they're running their own life pretty well. And, you know, we just say in those three areas, you know, health, wealth, and relationships, running. It doesn't mean everything's solved. It just means I feel like I know how to run this now. So,
yeah, you know, it's so fascinating to me, because it makes me think of, if you imagine someone who is say, working at a job that they feel like they're trapped in it, like they're not able to maybe have a ton of influence, right? What ends up happening is ultimately tend to either get resentment, or they get disengaged, or they have this habitual pattern of feeling smaller and smaller. And what ends up happening is, in a sense, hope leaves the picture. And because hope leaves the picture, the sense of agency does as well. But in a sense, when you can direct people to realizing that their narrative shapes a lot of their reality, it opens up new pathways, new opportunities to see, hey, actually, maybe there's a different way of looking at this. And what I love about what you're sharing is that it's this movement towards not only personal agency, but also what I was hearing is almost like a sense of humility, right? And I think both of those things, like this feeling of, hey, I'm not good enough, I can't really influence outcomes, and then on the other side, feeling like, okay, I know everything and I can influence all the outcomes, both trip us up substantially. What I love about what you're describing is it actually creates a tremendous amount of freedom. And I would imagine ultimately a sense of momentum, right? Because once you start moving and you realize, wow, this thing that I felt like I was going to be trapped in, the experience of it, right? Even materially, because we think that the material circumstances are what's dictating the experience, when those things do matter. Right. They do matter. Agreed. They do impact us, but it's totally different. Right. Like, and I just want to leave one more thing. Like, when you're even given the example of Uncle Joe, right? Uncle Joe's got a story as well. Right. And you can experience, like, Uncle Joe being a jerk is objectively what it is. But sometimes we can experience that as this really triggering, angering thing that makes us feel really small. But what you were just offering of, like, man, actually, there's maybe a lot of pain there. The thing is, Uncle Joe's the same person. You're interacting with him, and he's saying the same exact stuff. But when you realize, like, man, he's like a little kid who's really scared.
Yes, he is.
He's really scared right now.
Absolutely.
It changes the experience, right? And you can create that distance, so it's still happening, but it's not happening to you, right? You're an actor more than a reactor.
Yeah. So we talk about the difference between the content of you, like what you came into the world with, your particular talents, your particular intelligences, your particular gifts, and then the generic things like, you know, you got my attention with Monk Manu because of the being doing. And I went, oh, he's read up on the dual nature of people and he knows balances. You know, like people don't get happy if they're good at one and not the other. Like you have to be good at both of those. You know, so they come into the world with this dual nature, this desire for freedom. These things are built into infants when they're coming out of the womb. It's already there. And all of the particular ways, you know, their body, we can see red hair, blue eyes, and all of those uniquenesses. But they also have this other unique batch of talents, intelligences, personality stuff. So they come out, and that's the content of them, which is so huge. I don't think we can really comprehend that as a human being in ourselves or in other human beings. The content is beyond comprehension. But we know people in context. This is the kind of father he is. This is the kind of alcoholic he is. This is the kind of account manager she is. This is the kind of exerciser she is. This is the kind of whatever. And people know themselves that way too. Narrative shifting is almost always about, that's not you. That's how you were behaving in that context. The you of you is a lot bigger than that. And with respect to momentum and hope, so I just heard that you've been reading about high hope theory too. See, this is what I like about you. I know you actually are a psychologist in entrepreneur clothing or something here. Yeah, so high hope. If high hope is in the picture, people go, I think I can do that. There's a pathway. Others have done this before me. So they don't lose agency. They don't lose, they're called agency thoughts and pathway thoughts, right? How can this be done? And I can do it. When people are like, this can't be done and I can't do it. If that were really the truth, it is smart to sit on the couch and have a martini and binge watch Netflix. Mm. That's a smart move to stuff that you can do nothing about. Mm. And nobody has ever done anything about it. You know, if I said to you, hey, the building I'm in is 13 stories. Let's go to the top. And let's fly over the lake by flapping our arms. You would say, ah, interesting idea, Julie. I will just have another cup of coffee. And I really liked knowing you, but I'm going to stay here while you go do that. Nobody would do that. We wouldn't do it. Nobody would do it. So I do think it's very important to give people a little bit of a win, like help them with the thing right away, because they are demoralized. Mm-hmm. They're demoralized. Mm-hmm. I mean, people talk about that like it's a marketing thing. And I'm like, it's a psychological thing. They're demoralized. Mm-hmm. If they can get one thing to work, they will get the idea of like, oh, maybe. And then you help them with the next little thing. And then you're going like, this is feeling good. And it doesn't take that much. Mm-hmm. You know, people don't need 180-degree transformation for them to get some hope back.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I think that people are stronger and more ingenious than they actually imagine. Mm-hmm. Once they start thinking outside the box, once they're given that freedom of movement, they end up realizing, mm-hmm. hey, I thought there was option A and B. Well, actually, there's C, D, E, F, G, H, I, J, K, like all the way through. And then a lot of it really focuses on just choosing and discerning the right possibilities, right? And making sure that you're aligned with values, what your ultimate goals, desires are, what you were saying with that inner authority, leveraging that with the myriad of all those different opportunities. I want to ask you, because something that's part of my own experience with the Monk Manual is, as I allude to earlier, I see the Monk Manual actually as a meaning company more than even a productivity company. And it would take me a long time to probably explain all the ins and outs of why I say that. But a lot of the things even that we try to offer, some are more concretely, I think people can go and see, I can see exactly how this is going to work. But probably the thing that we've created that I think is the most transformational program is called Find Your Inner Monk. And really what it's doing is it's trying to rewrite a lot of narratives around personal meaning as they originate from kind of this post-industrial complex of the Industrial Revolution and all the ways that that's affected us and how we view our own worth and how we do kind of crowdsource meaning in ways that are maybe not so helpful. And so it's really a transformational thing. But the thing that's so interesting is I feel like it's a really hard thing to actually sell people on because I've seen a number of things where you talked about this where it's almost like we have this model of what works. And for most people in their consciousness, they don't think of, hey, I need to change my life. I'm going to go and I'm going to work on my narratives. They think it's something else. They think it has to be something else. And I would wager that most even self-help books do not really speak to, you know what, I've read even a lot of like recent, very popular habit-based books, right? And they have some good stuff, but they don't start with what I think is actually fundamental, which is the work that you're doing. So why do you think that is, that people do so much of what doesn't work? And then how is it that you help people to see how this really does work?
Mm-hmm. The short answer is they've been reduced, whether they know it or not, to some sort of mechanical way of going through life, like they are a cog in some wheel. Mm. And the only options they have are to get in a better wheel, take up some of the space of the other cogs. You know, there's a whole kind of scarcity mentality that is very profitable. I don't try to be too cynical, but it's a lot easier to control me if I have a scarcity mentality. Mm-hmm. I will stay in a job that I hate, that isn't good for me, but what are my choices? That's a scarcity mentality in there. As you've said, option A or option B, be employed or be unemployed. Or side hustles along the way. You know, there's a whole bunch of avenues forward, but they don't see them because scarcity mentality. When there's a sufficiency mentality, they start thinking differently. So I think the majority culture narratives, some of it is just meant to help people get along. Much of it serves a particular portion of the population, and it doesn't serve the others, but their marketing budget is bigger than mine, right? Mm-hmm. So how we actually get people to look at that is I use a lot of analogies. As an example, I have a webinar that I do. In fact, I'm doing one later this week. And there's going to be a slide. And on the slide, it's got three trees that look different, but that are all connected to the same river below. And I say, you can imagine if there is poison in that water, we could plant another tree, different brand, a different kind of tree. It's still going to die because the water that runs below it, narrative is like water. It undergirds everything that is above ground. So I use analogies like that. How do you change it, though? Mm-hmm. Well, two things. One is it's very easy to see somebody else's narratives that don't work. Piece of cake. You sit somebody in a room, say, you just talk about yourself and your life, you know, your health, your kids, your spouse, you know, your job, your career kind of impact you. You just talk about that for 15 minutes in front of any old group of people. And then if we had them now stop talking, and I said, what kind of narratives did you pick up there that you think are not serving him, not serving her, won't take her where she wants to go to? Let's start writing them down. Whole list. Do that for yourself. Hard to do. Because with the other person, you can easily see that's just a thing you're telling yourself, because they'll say, like, I'm not that smart. I don't think I could run a business. And you're sitting there going, are you kidding me? It doesn't even sink in. We don't even consider that. And now the hunt is on, you know, for like, what are the words that we can say to get him to believe he's smart enough to run a business? You can do that. Nothing wrong with that. And people feel loved and supported when you do that. And yay, keep it up. What actually needs to happen, though, is that we have an 8-step process, and the worst step is step 5, which is to lead people in the direction of experiencing the impact of that narrative, not just on yourself, but on everybody around you. And I always say, if you don't hate this step, you probably haven't done step 4 appropriately. Step 4 is writing an old story. Mm-hmm. Just get it on paper, private inner voice. What's really going on in there? What are you really saying to yourself? What do you really hear? And write it the way you hear it. Get the tone in there. You know, don't write it like, oh, I'm not smart enough to run a business. If what you're hearing is more like, who do you think you are? You flunked out of every class you ever took. You're never going to make it in business. God. What are you ever going to get this about yourself? If it sounds like that, they have to write it out like that. Hmm. And then we have them read it to another person, not to the whole group. But as you can imagine, those are pretty moving moments for everybody. We always do this, 2 people in a breakout. They read each other their old stories. And then that moves into writing a new story, which we start with the truth is. The truth is, I'm smart enough to run a business. I'm just frightened. I've failed so much. I don't want one more failure. Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Welcome to the world of entrepreneurs. We know what that feels like. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, the truth is, everything is figure outable. The truth is, others have gone before me, and I know people would support me. I know people want me to succeed. I know I could do that. So that's the new story. Some version of that. And we always have them read that. Once they have a new story that lands, we have them read that every day. Mm-hmm. Read it every day. Read it. It's a very powerful methodology. What I just described for everybody who's listening is a 4-month process. So that's called getting above the line. It's learning the basics of narrative shifting, mostly applying it to health, physical, emotional, spiritual, intellectual health. Inner authority means you are the boss of you. Mm-hmm. You are the one who has to listen to you, and you are the one that has to listen to your deep needs, and you are the one that has to say, this is a deep need of mine. How might I get this met? You're the one that has to do that work. Nobody can do that for you. Nobody can rewrite your narrative for you. Otherwise, we would have already done it for each other. Mm-hmm. So it's an acceptance of the responsibility you have to listen deeply to yourself. And to, on the one hand, humbly accept that I am a human being like the other humans on the planet. But I was given also a particular batch of raw material. Mm-hmm. And we don't know what would come of that if we started working with that. What could come out of that batch of things that are you? So what kind of context could you create from the content of everything you've been given?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Something that is really fascinating to me, not fascinating because I fully understand it, but fascinating because I've witnessed it and I witness it in myself. Mm-hmm. That I think on one hand, sometimes we don't engage the particular narratives in our life because we're just ignorant to them, right? It's like we're caught in some way, but we're not even aware that we're caught.
Yes.
But there's other times,
yes,
where I feel like we do deep down know that something's not right, something's amiss, and yet we're still... It's almost as if we're afraid to actually go there. We're afraid to actually go and name the thing. A, what's going on there? What have you experienced? And then B, how do you help people go and ultimately probably go to some of the places that are really, really scary for them?
Yeah. So number one, I think people don't go there because I think there's an appropriate, really appropriate reason. So let me defend all the people who don't do that. Once upon a time, I did this whole thing on does psychotherapy work? And so I went through like, yes, it does. Here you go. Here's this research. Here's it. And then the next slide on that, I said, maybe you don't know all that, but let's just say you did know all of that. Why wouldn't you go? And I asked that question to a number of people. And then I put together a compilation, captured what they were trying to say. Why wouldn't you call a therapist? Because I think on the other end of the phone is somebody who's going to look down on me, judge me. I will tell them everything, and they still won't be able to help me. And all I've done is make myself really raw and vulnerable. There you go. That's why they don't go. So one of the things that came out of that for me was I really believed that we needed to give people an anonymous way or as private as possible way where they could get help with this stuff because it is a normal human thing. It's a normal human thing. Nobody should have to go to a university for all of this stuff. They shouldn't have to go into a psychologist consultation office, shut the door for this. I mean, I don't remember how long it was into my private practice where I would come out going like, and that's the same point where I decided I should teach a thing. And that's the same thing. And at some point you go like, I think there's a course. There's a course here. Why don't I just teach this to anybody who wants to enroll? Because it's so universal. Why not do something that's universal and broadcast it to everybody out there? And we actually did that for a while. But I think the biggest belief, the biggest narrative, and it's, if I tear up saying this, it's because I can't stop thinking about on a regular basis how many people I think suffer under this. And I suppose it's my life work to end this particular belief. I think most people don't want to go there. I don't think it's that they believe it's going to be so ugly I won't be able to take it. I think they believe something like, I'm going to go there and I'm going to find out there's nothing there, that I'm nothing. Hmm. And I think that's people's deepest fear is that if they do all this deep work, they're actually going to find out like, well, Steve does deep work because there's depth to Steve. Hmm. And so he can go deep. Julie can go deep. Because there's depth to Julie. That's why she can sit around and think deep thoughts and make her life better. They both live in the deep end of the pool. When I dive in, I'm just going to break my neck because there's nothing there. Mm. And believe me, they did not come out of the womb with that idea. That is very much a shaming that happened along the way. I always tell people, look, I'm kind of a big fan of guilt, but that's different than shame. Guilt is, yeah, I went against my own values. I broke something. And go fix it. Go apologize. Go make up for it. Go fix it. And then thank the guilt for reminding you that that's a task of yours today. Shame is completely different. They shouldn't even be talked about in the same sentence, really. Shame is a feeling of, not that I behaved poorly. Shame is a feeling of like, I'm nothing. I'm not enough. All the talents are given to the others. Even God doesn't love me enough to give me what I need. Mm. And they have been taught that. Shame is a completely human created emotion. Like puppies feel a little guilt. If they chew on your shoe and you come in, you go, my shoe! When they look at it, that's guilt. But they don't feel shame. Animals don't feel shame. Shame is a human invented emotion and it's meant to control a human being. And guess what happens? You are super controllable. Super controllable. Mm-hmm. When you feel that. Anybody can get you to do anything. Just any place where you're good enough. They don't know yet, but I'm good enough to be here. It's not what was meant for us.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I appreciate you even highlighting that it feels very personal for you and it brings up a lot of emotion. Mm-hmm. And I imagine part of it is there's such a pain when someone's cut off from themselves, when someone's cut off from their own source, as it were, right? And knowing that place where so much of the person's inner treasure is, they don't even have the ability to access that. I mean, that's a very difficult experience of life. And beyond even that feeling of malaise, that feeling of being cut off, maybe that lack of vitality, that lack of inner inspiration, of just connection, because I experienced this myself. You know, I spent a lot of my life, I think, trying to get approval and trying to feel connection with other people until I realized, like, a lot of where the Christmas tree lights weren't connected was mostly internally, right? Like, that's where the strands had been pulled apart. And a lot of the connection, there was a lot more that was abundant within me. But that enabled me actually to receive a lot more of that abundance and connection externally, right? But it was kind of the inner work that had to happen first.
Well, but doing that by yourself, you might have been able to do that. Not many people can. Most people, I think, need to do that in some kind of a community, mm-hmm. because those narratives weren't installed by you. They were installed by others. And so when somebody else looks at someone who goes, "I'm nothing," I mean, they might not be saying those words, but you can sort of feel it. And then the other person goes, "I don't know if you know what it meant to me that you did this, and on this day, and this thing happened, I felt this," and I'd like, they can just feel, I can't let this narrative the other person has, I can't let that stand. It's not good. Mm-hmm. And nobody has to tell them to do that. They know to do it. Like, it's built in us. So psychologists have this phrase, self-concept is socially constructed. Self-concept is socially constructed. I learned who I am through your eyes. Mm-hmm. So when you have learned through others' eyes that you are nothing, you might be able to do that from the inside out. But it helps a lot if others say, "Yeah, I see a lot there. I know you're seeing nothing, but I'll tell you what I'm seeing." And I think we're built that way. You know, there's that old saying, "You're the sum of the five people you spend most time with." Like, I always wonder, where's the research on that? Like, it's a nice phrase, but where's the research on that one? You do need five friends. That there's plenty of research on. You should shoot for five friends that you could show up at their door at 3 a.m. and they would go like, "Yeah, come on in. I'm going to want some tea," right? You should have five people that, you know, that's the exact reception you're going to get or something like that. They're not going to go like, 3 a.m, dude, this better be good. You know, they're not going to do that. But I think that you should care about the approval of other people. We modify that to, you should care about the approval of, like, maybe that many people. Maybe. If it's more like that, I'm happier for you. And these two people, I mean, they should be walking on water for the most part. They should have gone through a lot and figured a lot out. It shouldn't be very many people. I always say, you shouldn't have a handful of people whose approval you care about. No. I said, you want to go for acceptance. You need about five people who accept you. Go for acceptance. Like, they accept you. You might need about five people, and you should go for acceptance in your life as opposed to somebody who decides that their approval or disapproval should be on your to-do list. Like, get that off your to-do list and then be around the people who accept you and get back to growing the way you were meant to grow. What's that supposed to be? I don't know, but it's going to be cooler than anybody else's idea about what you're supposed to be. Believe me, it's going to be cooler than what they wanted you to do as a job or a career, how they think you should be as a husband or a wife, how they think you should be as a parent. Like, we teach all of the science of relationship stuff. Like, here's the science. You apply it. You decide the right way to apply it. I'm not sure, but I can teach you the science. So, But we have to, people have to get away from any kind of an environment where shame is a big part of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Going back to this topic of being able to go and do it on your own, I'm of the belief that we had this whole category of self-help. I don't actually think self-help is real. What I mean by that is I don't think we actually do...
Good.
help ourselves. Like, self-help is a genre that's basically a pseudo relationship that's done in a monologue format. Hey, I'm going to go and give you this idea of here's all the things to do, but it's not in dialogue, so it's never going to be as effective. And I think that's why ultimately you can read self-help books, and I read, honestly, a lot of books in that genre. You take away certain things, but it's very rare that your life gets transformed by a book in that category, because their lives really do get transformed by relationships. For myself, I wouldn't be who I am today without the relationships I've had. I have a few friends who I think I can be very, very open with, honest with. I'm as honest with them as I am with myself, right? I know I still deceive myself in various ways, but in the ways I don't, I'm honest, and I've had therapists, mentors, coaches, and it's the relationships that can really transform us. And I want to pick up where you had left off talking about specifically this area of the relationship with our significant other, because a lot of times if people are in a relationship with someone and it's really close, that can be the relationship that brings up, I mean, in some ways, it has the path for being incredibly healing and incredibly meaningful, but also has the possibility of being, in some ways, the ultimate trigger, the ultimate place of vulnerability, the ultimate place of difficulty. Mm-hmm. Relationships can be hard. And you said something on a call we had previously, and I remember you talking about how a lot of times people, when they look at their relationships, part of the issue is their own narrative around it, almost like there's this special, well, is this person the right person for me, or are they not the right person for me, rather than realizing that a lot of it just has to do with skills and the way that you're actually engaging with each other. So can you share a bit about that and how, because I know that you're doing more work now in the relationship space, and you've been doing that. So could you just share a little bit about what that looks like?
Yeah. So there are particular narratives that are really bad for couples. And if one person has them, it's really bad. If they both have them, kudos to those couples, because they figure it out anyway lots of times. And it is a long, painful, unnecessary journey, in my view. So one of them is calculating payoffs independently is a really problematic narrative. You want to move towards what? Calculating payoffs interdependently. So if you think about football teams, the Buffalo Bills playing the Packers, right? Sure. Green Bay Packers. Somebody's going home a loser. It's a zero-sum game. A lot of people approach their spouse that way. You're on the other team. And so when I'm in my office working with a couple, I say, you know, we wouldn't think much of a quarterback if they saw their own receiver over there and they decided to pass it that way. We go like, what the hell are you doing? Because we know that they're, as a team, they're supposed to be making it easy on each other. When I pass it, when I pass it in a way that you can catch it, I'm going to pass it to where you're running to. I'm going to hand it to you if that's the right thing to do. It's the two of us, maybe against the world, but it's the two of us. I'm not against you. You're not against me. And that is a narrative that it is difficult for people to really fight. As soon as they get to it's you and me, it's always you and me. Once they get there, a lot of things get better, because it's automatic when you're on the same team. People automatically know that, like, right now it's time for the quarterback to shine. I'm a blocker. You know, nobody's going to even notice except on the replay tape, maybe. But it's my job, and I'm on this team, and that's what I do, because we all win together. So that's one of them. You have to move away from thinking of a marriage as a zero-sum game, which means that calculating your payoffs interdependently means you always think about what's good for the other person. If this is good for me, but it's bad for you, it's a no. If it's good for you, but bad for me, it's a no. It's got to be good for you and good for me. And you think, well, that's going to be a lot of work. It's actually, once you get the hang of it, it's kind of interesting fun and not that hard, frankly. It makes you more creative. That's one of them. Another one is, if we're fighting, there's something wrong with this relationship. And I always say, like, you don't fight with people you're not in a relationship with. That's an important thing to get. And they'll say, what? I'll say, look at all the people you bumped into today. You didn't start a fight with them. You know, the clerk at the grocery store, just sitting in the car next to the person who's sitting there at the red light with you. Did you start a fight with them? No, you didn't. You don't have a relationship with them. You only fight with people that you have a relationship with. So A, it doesn't mean there's something wrong, but it might mean, if it always goes bad, that you don't know how to take your disagreements and turn them into something that strengthens the relationship. Because that's not only possible, it's probable if you know what you're doing. So a fight, really, I'm going to say an honest fight, not where I'm trying to beat you because it's my turn to win, but an honest fight where I'm fighting for this because I can't give up on this thing. This is like deep in me. And the other person has the same thing. So that's what the fight is about. The fight is about, like, we disagree on strategy. We disagree, and it's important to us. We disagree on goals, and it's important to us. The one that's really hard is if you don't have enough overlap in values. That's kind of the definition of incompatibility. But I always say to people, like, don't jump there. If you don't know how to talk around different strategy and different goals first, don't jump to values. Mm-hmm. Like, let's just put that on hold for a moment. Because once you believe, for instance, that your spouse really wants for the kids exactly what you want, a good life that's happy, where they get to do what they were meant to do and they are connected with the people who love them, and you both want that, and you think the path is college, and they think the path is not necessarily college. You don't even know for sure if it has to be, you know, some sort of education beyond high school. And, you know, the two of them are sitting there going like, what? Why did you say that before we got married? I always thought all of our kids were going to go to college. Well, maybe all of them who are meant for college should go, but I don't think he's meant for college. You have been like that with him all in high school. You told him he never had to do his homework. That kid's self-esteem goes down when he does homework. That's because he doesn't know how to do it. So he learns that. See, they're both right. They're both right. And they're both fighting for the kid. They're both fighting for the kid. As soon as they get it, like, we're both fighting for the kid. All right. Go back to the part where you think he can't learn. What do you mean? Why? Now you get it to a little deeper conversation. But look, you wouldn't have uncovered a deeper need, you know, that child might have for each parent to be slightly different, or maybe quite a bit different with him than with the other kids. With the other kids, it was sort of skating. With this one, it's more complicated. They blame each other instead of, like, the other person's a resource here. Mm-hmm. Sees it differently than I do. So this is an event of observation. These are facts here. And we put different meaning to it. Yeah. And once we have a whole bunch of meaning, we might be able to come up with better solutions than what we're doing right now, which is just, he should go to college. He shouldn't go to college. Yes, he should. No, he shouldn't. Mm-hmm. People with college have better outcomes. Not if they hate college. Mm-hmm. On and on. The fight might mean that you have to learn how to talk more deeply with each other about things that are really, really important. If they're important to you, they're important to the other one too. So there's a kind of learning how to, like, do deep breathing while the fight is going on. There's a recovery conversation with people. It's a skill. And the fight's already happened. Maybe some damage was done. But at least you can go back and look at it and say, how did it happen? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's a recovery conversation. Once you get that skill up and running, it's a complete game changer. It's a hard one to do, but I just say this around here a lot, like, so what? It's a hard thing to do. What else is there to do? It's the only game in town. Mm-hmm. I mean, your job and all the other things really secondary to you being able to have this kind of connection with somebody that you love like that, who loves the kids you love and loves the life, likes the checking account to stay where it's at. Mm-hmm. And, like, that's the person. That's your person. That you, these skills have to be developed out. Or what's the other option? Mm-hmm. I mean, this is it. This is it. You have to develop these skills. There's one around here that we call becoming skillfully dependent. There's an idea that, oh, the problem is dependency. The problem is unskilled dependency. The solution is skilled dependency. It's not to become independent. You're independent of other people. Your spouse, you are dependent on. Not only are you're supposed to be. Now let's do it in a skilled way. Like, unskilled dependency has mining and complaining and accusing and has all that stuff that little kids do. If you start thinking of adults like they're tall children, and I don't mean that as an insult. I mean they're tender like that. Mm-hmm. They have emotional needs like little kids do. So if you think my spouse is a tall child, especially if you know you're good with kids, then what would you do for a child who's whining and complaining? And you would think, oh, she's sleepy. Mm-hmm. Or you go, like, she might be hungry. Mm-hmm. You go, like, he might need some alone time. Like, just leave him alone, everybody. Mm-hmm. Or you might go, come over here. What's going on? Mm-hmm. You know, you do all sorts, you have all sorts of skills mm-hmm. with those little unskilled kids. Mm-hmm. Well, you probably have an unskilled adult mm-hmm. child mm-hmm. that you've married, and don't look down on it for that, because part of what happens is when those needs are met, people get better and better. And especially if the couple knows that's what they're there to do. I am here to get skilled at being dependent on you. I had one guy say, I don't quite get what you mean. I said, I could sit here and listen to your wife all day long and understand exactly what she's trying to get across to you, and it will make just about that much difference to her, because you are the person, because she loves you and you are her husband. You are the person she cares about understanding her. Like me, that's probably nice, but it's not that important to her. Mm-hmm. You understanding her. She is dependent on you. And he said, well, maybe she shouldn't be dependent on me. And I said, she can't help herself. She's always going to want to know if you admire her, if you look up to her, if you understand the path that she thinks she's conquered, because she's sleeping with you. You're the one next to her day and night. Not me. I'm a bit player in your marriage. You're the main character. Mm-hmm. And she's always going to want that. And he said, this is not going to get easier. I said, it's going to get easier if you see the significance of you in her life, which is why you coming in and acknowledging her means a lot. Me coming in and not acknowledging her, well, yeah, it's okay. At least I'm civil. That's cool. But you saying the same thing would just light her world up. She's always going to be dependent on you for that kind of love and attention, because she wants that kind of love and attention from you. It's just like kids who are getting all the praise and whatever from the coach or the teachers, and the parents don't know anything about them. They come home and they're like, what? You don't care? I just got straight A's. You don't care? This was a hard semester for me. You don't care? It's the same exact thing. Mm-hmm. Same exact thing with spouses. So I think most spouses that I know, not all of them, but they're pretty good with understanding the vulnerability of children. They might not know exactly all the things to do, but they do get it that children are more vulnerable. And they just bringing that same skill set, those same narratives to your spouse, it's a game changer. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I've seen exactly what you're talking about, and just even in my own relationships, how at the end we are really just, in a lot of ways, taller children, right? And you can see how sometimes someone, it might be like, this is the worst person in the world, but really it's just like they need a nap. You know what I mean? They just need that afternoon nap.
I just need a nap. Just give them a nap.
They just need their quiet time. I want to ask, as we're rounding this out, for people who are interested in potentially rewriting some of the narratives that are in their life, if they recognize that maybe they're feeling a little bit stuck, or they're feeling like something's just not truly working. I know a really important thing that we've been circling around here is actually, it is so much easier if you're in community, if you're working with a coach, if you're working with a group, even more so a group that's actually targeted around the same purpose. I mean, in a lot of ways, that's one of the things about being a monk that is so effective, right? Is you have all these people who go for the exact same reason to go and grow in the same direction, right? So it at least has the potential, and I don't want to go and say every single monk is a perfect person, but it has the potential as a system of being really, really effective. But aside from those avenues, those maybe more structured, either group formats or working with a coach or a therapist or something of that nature, are there any practices that people could take away today that they might be able to go and start trying out in their life to try to maybe, if nothing else, gain some awareness or some clarity or some next steps?
So I always say, start journaling. Just start. And when people are like, I don't know what to write, I'm like, don't worry about that. You can get one. You can get a journal that has prompts. Like, that's one of the things I like about the Monk Manual. It's got prompts in it. But you can go get a journal that has prompts in it, or you can get a blank journal. But if people are new to journaling, I always say, don't journal too much. Like, get up in the morning, make a cup of tea, get a nice chair, you know, get a journal you like to write in, get a pen you like to write with, and then set a timer. That's the important part. Set a timer. Don't journal any more than 5 minutes. And they'll say, I can't write for 5 minutes. I'm like, you don't have to just sit there for 5 minutes. And when a thing comes up that catches your attention, just write that down. Maybe it's going to be one sentence that day. And I always say, date it. You know, always date every entry because a year from now, you might be surprised to look back and see what's there. But I think that's the best self-help that somebody can do. And I wanted to say something to you that I don't, do you know that the number one thing that reading a self-help book predicts?
No.
That you will read another one. That's it. So sure. I always think the self-help industry is probably being supported by 100 people out there who buy 1,000 books every year. I don't know, but you know, for those of you who are like, wait, that self-help book didn't work and I'm going to get another one and at some point I'm going to land on the right stuff. I'm not opposed to you buying all those books. They're good books written by good-hearted people who know a thing. It's just that the application of that is where the rubber hits the road. And I think journaling is one of those. I also think keep a really close eye. So this is going to be what to get out of your life. Keep a close eye on the conversations that are happening, not inside your head, but outside your head. Real conversations that you're having. And spend more time in conversation with people who use words like opportunity, and they use words like gratitude, and you can just feel that they use words like celebration. They aren't Pollyanna people. They're not, there's lemonade in every lemon. I'm not saying that. I'm saying that their outlook is one of there's enough of everything for everybody. It's not an abundance one. It's a sufficiency mentality, we call it. If you are around people with scarcity mentalities, and you can feel the envy in them, and they're always looking at, yeah, that's cool. They have money and they have a boat, but look at their kids aren't great. You know, there's a whole kind of, instead of like, oh, that was a nice ride they invited us all in the boat. Like, you know, but their kids are like, be sympathetic to people who have that scarcity mentality because they're suffering. But look, because we are built to be in a relationship with each other, that stuff in them is going to automatically come in you. So you have to think about, would I have my child be with this person all the time, given the level of negativity that is ever present? No, you would not. You would pull your child. You wouldn't like push that person out of your life necessarily, but you would pull back because there's only so much of that a human being can take. So you have to, besides seeking out, you know, that kind of a monk-like community, take a look at who you're spending time with and their narrative. You can be empathic for what they might be going through, but that doesn't mean you getting sucked into that negative vortex is going to be of help to them, because it's not. It will be of no help to them for those narratives to get more airtime. It actually hurts them for them to be rehearsing. Oh, it's called negative rehearsal, rehearsing that negative stuff over and over and over. Like, it's not good for them, not good for you. People who gossip, not so good. Spend time with people who are interested in what you're up to in your life. They're perfectly willing to reveal what they're up to in their lives, and the whole conversation is about the two of you or anybody who's present. If it's a, you know, mimosa kind of Sunday morning, the conversation shouldn't be about all the people who aren't there. It should be about the people who are there. You have to keep an eye on it, make sure you're not exposed. You know, parents know this about kids. I just think you need to select your own communities. And when people ask me about mine, I say, well, I'm a little next level on that one. I always go to creating my own. I'm like, I know what I want. I'm going to look for it in people. Those are the people I'm going to invite for card club. The people I'm going to say, Christmas party, yes. They're on the Christmas list. Mm-hmm. You know, these are people we're going to go bicycling with. So, do you join a biking club? I mean, you can, but I created my own. So it's not that hard to do. And it's because I'm ambitious. It's because I want to have, I want to make a bigger mark on the planet. And when you are around, you know, go outside taking a deep breath. Hopefully it's good air. Right? You need to fill your lungs. Hopefully with good air. So to me, it's like, the community is the air you're breathing. So get some good air going for yourself.
Dr. Helmreich, I love this so much. All this has been so wonderful. For anyone who wants to learn more about your work, who wants to learn more about some of the different things that you are providing, some resources they can dig into, where can they find you?
They can Google my name, so www.juliehelmreich.com. So that's probably going to be in the show notes here somewhere.
It will be. I want to just say thank you. That was, I felt like, incredible.
Thank you.
Like, I think people are going to really, really love this. I really do.
Yeah. You and I should meet in person someday, because
yeah,
every time
be
we have a conversation, it's very nice. So I enjoy it.
Thanks for listening to today's episode of Potent. If you'd like to learn more about Dr. Helmreich and her work in narrative shifting and getting unstuck, please visit juliehelmreich.com. That's juliehelmreich.com. I'd like to end each episode by encouraging you, the listener, to identify something from today's episode that you'd like to change or incorporate into your life as a result of what you heard today. Don't let ideas stay ideas. Find one small action you can take starting today to set yourself on a path to a fuller life. If you haven't already, I invite you to subscribe to this podcast and leave us a review. It's a free way that you can support this program and help us reach more individuals seeking to live a fuller life. You can also follow us on YouTube and Instagram. Links to both are available on our website, thepotentpod.com. And now, some inspiration for the week ahead. An old Cherokee chief was teaching his grandson about life. "A fight is going on inside me," he said to the boy. "It is a terrible fight. It is between two wolves. One is evil. He has anger, envy, sorrow, regret, greed, arrogance, self-pity, guilt, resentment, inferiority, lies, false pride, superiority, and ego. The other is good. He has joy, peace, love, hope, serenity, humility, kindness, benevolence, empathy, generosity, truth, compassion, and faith. The same fight is going on inside you, and inside every other person too." The grandson thought about it for a minute and then asked his grandfather, "Which wolf will win?" The old chief simply replied, "The one you feed." Until next time, wishing you all the best.